So, I'm your representative from Sheet 16. And a good deal of you are from Sheet 16. But what our preoccupation is mostly the non-trivial and deep constraints that come in when you try to deform a two-dimensional elastic manifold, like that. You get all kind of structure that you wouldn't have believed would be tractable. And the remarkable thing is that there's a couple of deep principles that make it tractable. That's what the bulk of this, a good deal of the Sheets program is about. What I want to talk about today is, on the face of it, much simpler and more Mickey Mouse. And yet, it gives us a kind of a shockingly simple and beautiful behavior. This is called a compressed floating sheet. And the main guy on this is my collaborator, Chaim Diamant, who many of you know and who was here for a while. And if you should want to dig into this, here's our two papers. That tells what we were able to do on this. But mostly, we spin our wheels and lose sleep over this. And my highest hope is I can make you spin your wheels and lose sleep, too. We can share the pain. Let's see. So, let me start out with chapter one, a mundane little problem. I was going to put that over here. A mundane but nasty little problem. It's a simple mechanical buckling problem. In which I have a flat sheet of plastic or some kind of material, and I exert some pressure on it such that it comes in a little bit, it deforms in one dimension, no Gaussian curvature in this problem, it deforms by some amount delta, and since this thing has a fixed length L, there's not room for it anymore, and so it has to do some kind of buckling. A one-dimensional deformation. The question is, what's that buckling like? It's a classic problem, and you can describe the buckling, which we'll do throughout this talk, by looking at the arc length S. Oops, the arc length U. And at every point U, there's some angle, phi of U. You know, if I know phi of U, I know how this thing buckled. We can ask ourselves what even makes this a well-defined problem. What's the energy that is trying to minimize the buckling energy? It's a local energy, local in the coordinate U. And the energy that we're paying here is bending energy. And if phi was a constant, of course, it would just be another plane, and there wouldn't be any bending. So it's proportional to d phi du. And it doesn't matter if you're curving it down or curving it up. It's an even function of that. It's a square. And of course, we're physicists. We're going to call this phi dot, and we're going to pretend that u is time later in the talk. So let's say phi, we just suppose delta is very small, and we suppose phi is phi max times cosine ku. Of course, k, this is corresponding to a wavelength, which is 2 pi over k. And for a given delta, there will be some phi max and some k that minimize this energy, we think. And we can easily estimate that. Du phi max squared. And then this derivative is going to make a k squared. So this goes from 0 to L. So this is going like k squared L. And I want to minimize it. So I should take k, go to 0. Or at least as k as small as I can be. The longest wave I can make. And everybody knows that's what happens when you do this problem. It just makes a half wave like this, Euler-Buckling. That's the warm-up problem. Now, this is not the puzzle I wanted to tell you about. I'm not that old. The real problem I want to tell you about is the floating compression. It's the same as this one, except I'm pushing on here. I'm going to have a compression with a displacement delta, just like before. I'm going to have a one-dimensional deformation, just like before. The only difference is that underneath this one, is water. So the wavelets means there is water. There's a new piece to the energy, and I want to show you that this problem suddenly gets kind of ugly. There's certainly the same bending energy that there was before. And also, there's E gravity. So E gravity is the integral dx rho g 1/2 h squared. So now let's put our sine wave in. So this goes to...
What is H?
Thank you, sir. H is the height of this wave.
And
you.
Is it dampening?
What?
Is it dampening also?
No. This is static. It's just sitting there.
And why is the height squared that goes into the gravitational energy?
Well, you know, the pressure is proportional to the height. If you push down something. But we want the energy. So you have to integrate P to H. So, you know, if I pulled something up, I'd have to do work just as much as I would have to do work if I pulled it down. So now, this has an energy that you can write down, but let's before we do that, let's just look at phi of that form. So H is going to be phi max, and what did I do with this? Times how much H is, how much will this H be? It goes up to an angle of phi max. Let's look at this angle phi max. And H is increasing, and the total amplitude of H is about phi max times lambda. So phi max over k. So this one, this gravitational energy, goes like L phi max squared over k squared. We saw here that the banding energy likes, it goes in the inverse power of k, it likes small k, the gravity hates small k. So it will not do, if you want to optimize this energy, to just take k, goes to zero. This makes a great big hump, lifts the thing much more than it needs to lift for the given delta. So there's some magic non-zero k star which minimizes this energy. And so the solution for very small is phi equals phi max, also very small, times sine k star u. So now I want to show you something else about that, which I was supposed to tell you about here. I want you to think about how this p increases with delta. So p is dE, d delta. And
how do we switch boundary conditions?
I can believe I would do that. Thank you. Do I need to fix anything else on this? I'm confounding different. I'm just trying to get the scaling with length scale here. Clearly, knowing how delta, the energy goes with delta, I can find out how P increases with delta. And it goes linearly with delta. When delta is very, very small, it takes a lot of pressure to get this started. And if I increase it more and more, it takes more pressure. But each increment of pushing takes less extra pressure. In other words, this thing is the pressure is decreasing sublinearly. This, in other words, it's self-softening. This is just a property of that bending energy. And that bending energy is here too. And so this is also self-softening. But this self-softening makes a new property, self-localization. So what I'm about to tell you is that now, no matter how small you make delta, well, there's certainly a linear expansion of this energy, and its solution is this sinusoidal wave going across the system. Where did I put the energy? What I meant to say is, and E min is now phi max squared, using this. What did I say? The energy, it's the bending energy and the total energy are comparable. K star squared L. The main thing I wanted to point out, which you see completely from this picture, is that this one is extensive at minimum, whereas the simple Euler buckling is subextensive. Okay, now, why does that mean it's self-localizing? So let's say delta is very small. I have a perfectly good solution here. It's this plane wave. And I claim no matter how small I make it, that is unstable. And the real minimum with a given delta will be a finite size region of excitation. And just you get an idea why that is, you can look at compare extensive to localized. Extensive is this way. A phi is going along like this. I'm going to make 10 waves. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. To B. B has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 with a higher amplitude and then nothing in between. Okay? I claim this EA is greater than EB. And why? Let's look at not E, but the pressure. Here's this one has an extensive energy, so I can just look at the energy of this part of it. This has a deformation delta over 2. I meant to say something else. The trouble is, I don't look at my notes enough. This one is self-softening. But now, the self-softening is, the degree of self-softening is measured by lambda, lambda star. And now with this graph, if I look at the pressure, I look at the total energy, and the energy of this one is the energy of the left half plus the energy of the right half, which is just as big. Okay? So this is E, I'm sorry, P A. Okay? Now, I put them both together, and then, so this was delta. It's all uniform with a higher, with double delta. But this pressure is smaller because of the softening. PB is less than PA, and so EB is less than PEA. You can see that just to try to be, to give them ideas about it, I have been rather sketchy and skipped over steps. But I think it's enough to show you that this is the concavity or the bending properties of this energy is enough to force us to be able to gain energy from collapsing this excitation into a smaller space. Well, it's smaller than the whole system. How much smaller is it in the end? It localizes in the end to a length 1 over kappa. It's independent of L. It goes, kappa does go to 0 as delta goes to 0. So the degree of this localization is less and less if I make the amplitude smaller and smaller. Nevertheless, no matter how small I make delta, if I have a big enough system, the wrinkling is going to be in an infinitesimal part of it. Okay, so this localization is basically due to the nonlinearity of this equation, which I have not spelled out in detail, but I will. It is nonlinear, but you can certainly solve it numerically. So delta much, much less than lambda star, the magic wavelength, the phi over u is going like this, and delta of the order of lambda star, again numerically, looks something like that. And of course this fold gets bigger, deeper, taller, bigger and bigger angles as delta gets bigger and bigger. Okay, so this is of mild interest, but I wouldn't be bothering you about this if it was just for this.
Are you saying what really happens is that instead of figuring out where it's going to put the wiggles in the middle of the system,
yes,
it makes one big fold in the middle?
All the extra costs that it gained from making a bigger amplitude, it more than made up for by getting rid of the energy, marshaling in all the energy from the edges. We know problems like this, like self-trapped polarons are like this.
Yeah.
There's this thing called a sulcus of how you bend a big fat. You bend a big fat rubber tube. It was invented by Mahanavan. And once again, there's localization at infinitesimal amplitude. So that's not what's so funny about this thing. The funny thing is chapter 2. The miracle. So suppose I were to tell you that suppose I said that phi of u of this messy system was 4 tangent to the minus 1, a certain kappa divided by a certain k sine ku over cosh kappa u. That's so important, I'm going to put it over here. Phi equals 4 tan inverse kappa over k sine k u over cosh kappa u. If I told you this, I'd say, well, this is the answer. No, that's nothing special about it. You would demand to know why. You wouldn't sit still for that. It's a closed form and it's very simple, despite all this nonlinearity. In a second, I'm going to show you the partial differential, the linear differential. No. The ordinary differential equation that this thing satisfies, and you wouldn't believe there's a chance in the world that it could be so simple. So the question is, who ordered that? Oh, I should tell you, kappa is equal to delta k star over 4, and kappa squared plus k squared equals where kappa star is the incipient buckling wave vector. Okay, so this is what Haim and I have been losing sleep over, and we've been casting about trying to figure out how it could be possible that the answer would be that simple. And I thought, if there's anywhere in the world I could give this talk and get some progress, it would be here. That's why I wanted to do it. So now, let's see. The next thing is chapter 3. Oh, before I finish chapter 2, the burning question is, who ordered that? In other words, what feature of the system is responsible for this simple behavior? Otherwise put, what is the class of systems that have this responsible feature for which this kind of miracle should be expected? So we've seen miracles like this before, especially in classical mechanics class, and the efforts that Haim and I have made to understand it have been using those physicist tricks. So the next thing I have to do is show you that this is a dynamical system. You're not surprised about that, but I just want to show you explicitly. Is Hamiltonian dynamics. So, I don't think I need this anymore. Let me just put this down on paper to give you the sense that when you put it in the form a physicist would say it, in which it would be expected that the miracle would be, the reason for it would be shown. Hamiltonian formulation total, we said, was, but now I'm going to talk about pressure, P. E total is the E bending that I showed before, plus the E gravity that I showed before, plus the pressure energy, which is just P delta. Don't put it like that. Both of these can be, all of these can be expressed as an integral over U. Y dot squared over 2. There's the bending energy. Gravity, I said it was h squared dx, but that means it's h squared sine. This, it really is cosine phi. P delta, well, that's just P. And then the delta is 1 minus cosine. Is that true? Yes.
So what is H? H is...
What was H?
H is a function of U?
Yes, H is a function of U.
Why do you need... What's cosine phi?
Well, we said the energy, remember we said dx H squared? H squared times a constant? But we're not integrating dx. We're integrating du. So this is as was just said, these are the two dynamical variables. It doesn't look Hamiltonian yet. But it sort of looks like classical mechanics, which you're not surprised to learn.
But H is really a function that's determined by phi of U.
Yeah, it's there's a constraint.
It's a non-local.
It is, yes, sir. It is a non-holonomic constraint, right out of classical mechanics. And a way to say it is that H, VH, VU is equal to sine. I don't trust myself. Yeah. Sine phi. That's a constraint. It cannot be expressed as... by just giving H as a function of phi, but I have to have the derivative of H.
So it knows about the whole history of H.
So this is, it knows, yeah, it knows everything from the left edge, let's say.
And you're allowing these sort of reentry shapes?
Yes, sir. I want to formulate this. And in U space, going along the arc length, there's no problem with this. Now, this is not, I can't just minimize this. I have to include this constraint. And of course, we do this with a Lagrange multiplier. E effective is equal to E total plus some something that forces this to be true at every U, namely the U some Q 1 minus H dot minus sine phi. So now I'm good to go. I can just minimize this, and it's just, this is just Hamilton's principle with this functional. So I have minimize EFF, the effective energy of phi dot, H, and H dot, which is defined to be this integral of L of phi dot, H, and H top. It's in a perfectly good form, just that the Hamiltonian is a little bit screwy. You have to express the Hamiltonian not in terms of the dotted quantities, but in terms of conjugate momentum. And I'm just going to write it. 1/2 P of phi squared. We had phi dot squared, so you get P of phi squared for the same reason. Plus a linear dependence on the H momentum, sine phi, minus the gravity energy, couples them, cosine phi, and then finally, P, 1 minus cosine phi. It's screwy to have a Hamiltonian with a linear dependence on momentum, but this does not screw up the workability of the Hamilton's equations. So why did I go to the trouble of doing this? To give you to shock and awe, that's why. It's a nasty Hamiltonian. And it can be, I can write down the equations of motion, turn the crank, and get the differential equation for phi. So, fold equation. Phi dot, 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 plus 3/2 phi dot squared. Plus P phi dot dot plus sine phi zero. It's fourth order, it's nonlinear, and we are able to get a unique solution because we know that phi equals phi dot equals zero for U equals plus infinity or minus infinity. So I have a fourth order equation for boundary conditions, and that gives me an answer. So, and you can get it numerically. It's well posed. The question is, why is it so unabashedly simple? And but now we can start to unroll our artillery and use our usual ways of assessing simplicity. And that's chapter, what am I up to? Chapter 4. Integrability.
You need two more boundary conditions.
No. I got two on the left and two on the right. Well, I could have three on H. H goes to 0, too. It happens, you know, H is tied up with phi dot.
H should be 0.
H should be 0.
But it's an integral sign.
Yeah, in the middle it's not 0. But by the time you get to the other side, we have a localized fold, and it's got to have no energy and no nothing. And
I just don't see how it follows from the boundary condition.
Right. You do see that these boundary conditions, albeit they only apply to phi, they specify a solution. What's not clear is if they properly give the behavior of H. And I'd rather gloss over that because I don't think it's that they do. Oh, you're so, yeah, you're thinking, geez, it's an integral. How did it come out to be automatically satisfied? It's in that integral that you...
If you integrate sine phi, you get an integral total derivatives.
That's right. Okay, so what makes dynamical systems simple for all that we were learning in school is... is this condition of integrability. So I'll give you a small rundown on integrability. Integrability of a dynamical system means that I can find the motion in our case, phi of u and h of u, and express it in terms of mere integrals. May not be obvious that doing integrals is qualitatively simple than solving differential equations, but it is simpler. And when it is possible, it is called integrability. And then we have conditions that everybody in this room knows. Suppose I have an n-variable system. This is a two-variable system. And there's several things we know. One, the main thing is it's integrable if there exists n quantities, independent quantities, functions of P of the of all the variables, such that they're conserved. Their time derivatives are zero, they're conserved. Whenever that's true, you can split the problem up into one-dimensional problems, and you get an integrable system. So our only hope to explain this is to somehow find a justification for it being integrable. So now, I just want to remind you of a couple of examples.
It should be an involution, actually, not only conserved.
I should be which?
Involution. I mean, the Poisson brackets between these things should be always.
This is true. This is true, and I hid that under the statement that I didn't even write down by saying they were independent, but they have to have mutual Poisson brackets vanishing. So we have to find if we can hope to explain this, we have to find such a P. Let's see. I gave a couple of examples here, which are worth to know. If n equals one variable and the h is time independent, then h dot equals zero. And we already have our variable. And that for an n equals 2, we know another case, central force motion. Here's a particle going around in U of R, and then it is integrable too, and that is because not only we can find the energy is not changing in time, but also the angular momentum. And And that's because of a symmetry. What I'm trying to say to you is that we need to find a symmetry. So this is what we've been trying to do, and we've made some kind of cobbled together answer, which I'm about to tell you. It's kind of like, it's not satisfactory, but I'm going to tell you. Finally, one other way to state this criterion, or the quantum description has degenerate. These are energy eigenstates, and you all know from the hydrogen atom, there's a whole family with different angular momentum, but they have exactly the same energy. This is another way of saying these very same criteria for integrability. Okay, now let's. Now it's where I'm going to try to make some connection between our system and these integrables. But there's not a symmetry in sight. You notice that this is ugly. It's not invariant under anything. It's invariant under change of time, U. But any Hamiltonian is like that. It's conserved. But we have N equals 2, and we don't have integrability unless we have at least one other variable. So this, I notice one thing about this thing. This is a very sort of flaky argument, but to try to motivate what how Higham managed to discover this thing. If you look at the Hamiltonian, it has quite a bit of potentials. It has quite a bit of dependence on phi, but notice that this dependence on phi is of a very particular form. Of course. If I had none of these interactions on at all, phi would be able to be any angle at all, and it would just stay there. It's invariant under wrapping phi around this 2 pi circle. There are eigenstates of that translation in phi, and these things are the best known examples. They're called modular functions. And we have a Hamiltonian that's linear in these modular functions, for what it's worth. So one Hail Mary approach to try to understand the hidden symmetry is to look at the simplest system we can that has that description. Phi double dot, I'm going to say it in time, real time, is sine phi. The good old physical pendulum. This is the daddy of all these, of all problems of this form. And I'm going to write down the answer, which shockingly is enclosed form. Tan plus or minus 4 inverse tangent of A e to the plus or minus q t. What I want to point out about this is, first of all, it is shockingly simple. And second of all, it's continuable into complex time. This allows you to bootstrap into this system, into a hierarchy of related systems. Of which this thing I drew with the pendulums is one. So let me explain this system. This is another one step closer to our system thing that has this modular property. I've got a row of pendulums here. They're numbered by a discrete variable S, and they're swinging back and forth, and they're coupled. See this little line in between? They're swinging back and forth, and these pendulums, the bigger they swing, the easier it is for them to swing, so to speak. And the result of this is it's possible for the energy of the pendulums to stay localized. It's a self-localizing system like our folded sheet is. Here I've tried to draw the angle phi, this angle phi, as a function of position and as a function of time. Well, these pendulums swing back and forth, but they keep the energy inside. They keep it localized with S. You can see it decaying as I go away from my most excited pendulum. Okay. And so now I'm going to tell you the continuum version of that. It's the Sine-Gordon equation, wherever it is, d squared phi ds squared minus d squared phi dt squared equals sine phi. Okay. Now, this mode I have written here, where it's localized, is called a breather. And you might believe that from this embedding property of into the complex plane of time, I can use this solution of the physical pendulum to write down the equation of breather. And here it is. For tangents, it looks like this. To the minus 1, k, kappa over k, sine kt plus c1 over cosh kappa s plus c2. Now, this is nothing to do with our system yet. This is the Sine-Gordon equation. It's all very nice that it's integrable. We knew it was integrable. We know all kinds of things about the Sine-Gordon equation. Nevertheless, there is a hierarchy of equations corresponding to these related systems, and they are, some of them are as fancy as the ones of our fold equation. So, we could ask ourselves, is the let's see, is there a U of S and T such that phi of U is equal to phi breather? Well, this is a real Hail Mary enterprise, but it works. Chaim knows way more about this, and there's a better motivation, I'm sure, than I'm telling. But at the end of the day, you just try this, and it works. Okay, so this gives us some clue of why there should be the symmetry. And it tells us what is the symmetry. Yes, there is. I should tell you, U equals S plus T. In other words, here's U. What I'm supposed to do, according to this, is take this Sine-Gordon equation and look at the breather solution along this light cone, as it's called, and look at the angle as I go along, and that angle, well, it's this. For fixed V, so this U with S minus T equals V, fixed. This gives a way of showing very concretely in this language what the symmetry, what the extra symmetry is. So, look, I went along this line, this light cone here, and I made a fold. Why didn't I? What would be wrong with going across along this light cone right here? Nothing. Everything is invariant under shifts of this of either S, T, or anything. It makes the shape of this thing different. At the middle of this this line here, the phi was a maximum, close to a maximum. If I shift it over, I can make it be a zero or zero derivative. I can make it be a different functional thing. This is not a trivial thing, like just sliding the fold off to the right. This is a non-trivial kind of Faison symmetry. And so translation in V now, this identifies asymmetry, but what I want to close with is that this begs the question. It says, somehow, our fold system just knew that it was supposed to be like the Sine-Gordon equation, which is embedded in two dimensions. Once you have said it's embedded in two dimensions, you can talk about this symmetry, and it's obviously a symmetry of the system. But why should it have been, what should there have been about this intrinsic problem that would give us any clue that that was true. So, but why? I've given you a couple of hints of what seems like a possible answer to that. But why? One, I've kind of mentioned there. There is some kind of a symmetry in this that we haven't got our hooks into yet.
I haven't gotten your hooks into. You mean you can't write down the quantity that's conserved?
I can't write down a transformation under which my thing is invariant.
Forget about the symmetry.
Or I can't write down. Once I know this V symmetry, I can write down a quantity that's conserved.
Can you write it down?
We call it. It makes translation in V. And so it's kind of like the Hamiltonian.
It's a function of U now.
No. It lives in U and U dot, and it has all the. Oh man. Let me just say briefly what it looks like. It looks like you shouldn't be surprised that since the Hamiltonian translates U and U, something that looks like this should translate U and V, and it does kind of look like this, but the not in any obvious way. And I think, let's see, if I were to write it down, I don't think you'd say, aha, David. But I'm going to show you afterwards, but I'm kind of late, and so I wanted to give my last hurrah here. Even if I know this thing, come back to me. Even if I know this function, it still doesn't get to the problem. So, okay, it's translation invariant in V. Who told us there should even be a V?
That's why it's not obvious that you can write it down.
I guess it isn't, but this is to Chaim's credit. He pieced together bit by bit what his derivatives had to be, what his second partials had to be, and he came up with this function. We call it the Cameltonian. So, it should be Hamiltonian. But one thing, possibility, is this modular thing I was mentioning. There's some sense in which you can rotate phi and have this thing be the same as itself. I won't say anything more about that. Another thing has to do with the thing I said of this criterion for integrability, the degeneracy. In order to address, to use this criterion, what we have to do is take this Hamiltonian as it stands and quantize it. We make a wave function. And suppose we do that. The funny thing about these wave functions is they're degenerate in a funny way because of their self-localizing property. So I'm supposed to think of you as time. I'm going to make my lowest energy state. What does it look like in time? It looks like an instant time. It goes nothing, nothing. Blah, 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 blah. And so that means any state that gets big any place in time is as good as any other. I shouldn't get them too close together, but if I space them far apart in time, of psi 0 of h of u plus c 1 phi of u plus c 2 no, you're saying I'm supposed to have to translate everything together is equal to e of psi 0 of h of u and phi of u. This would be funny if this was true, because we know lots of systems that self-localize, and this, if there's anything to this, it says you should expect some kind of a degeneracy for any such system, and at least one step on the road to integrability. And that's what the puzzling thought that I'd like to leave you with. Thank you.
Since Tom is around, I think we'll have a very abbreviated question period. There are questions. So let's take
There were good questions during the
there
talk.
There were very good questions. There might not be any left.
Yep, David.
It's only, it's not exactly localized, it has tails.
Yeah, but it falls off exponentially. I mean, it has
still
pretty.
It can affect a little bit the eigenvalues.
Yeah, so it's like localization and Anderson localization. You know, they're localized enough that it's a discrete spectrum. So another case, by the way, to just kind of whet your appetite about this, is another. What do we know any quantum states where there is also self-localization, and we know one, it's a quantum Hall effect. There we have complete degeneracy that just has to do with translation. And this quantum Hall system has, of course, all kind of beautiful simplifying properties. And it's intriguing to think that some fraction of those might come merely from the fact that a system is self-localizing.
You said it was independent of L?
Yeah.
So the localization could occur anywhere?
Yes. And for the tiniest delta that you like. That's the deal. Just like in quantum Hall, you can have your whatchamacallit, orbit any place you want. That is a kind of symmetry. You would think Yes, but we've used that symmetry, that's translation symmetry, and no double dipping. But it's not quite the same, because it's something that you couldn't have said without the being self-localizing. And I never heard of that being a symmetry. That's the thing I can't get my head around.
Are there experiments, situations that behave like this?
Would you take a computer experiment? An experiment on self-localization. There are self-localizing excitons, there are self-localized polarons. And those are experiments.
And does a coupling sheet do this? A floating coupling sheet do this?
So what you can see in the floating crumpling sheet is you can just make it out of plastic. You can also make it out of molecules. I didn't give the motivation for this, for studying this in the first place, but there are monomolecular sheets whose pressure versus displacement is very important, because this is what happens when you breathe.
Yeah.
So you can do a macroscopic version of this, and we've done it with all different kind of particles on the surface, and you indeed see this fold shape that looks like the thing I erase, and you can match them one on top of the other. Those experiments are not the most accurate thing in the world.
That's fine.
But you have to, if you believe this equation, you can run this equation numerically and get.
On that note, we have to kind of chop it. You're here for a while, so
I'm here for weeks.
Have other questions? Just fine. Thanks a lot.
Yes.